It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Gibson's Bakery and Oberlin College has been going on for the past few years. It all started back in 2016 when protesters took to the streets.
Boycott Gibson's!
It was a call for a boycott that began a years-long battle. It came after a shoplifting incident inside the bakery that gained attention on campus. Student protesters made claims of racial profiling after a white employee confronted a black student, suspecting him of shoplifting. According to the police report, two other students got involved and assaulted the employee. All three students later pled guilty to misdemeanors and also read statements in court saying that the employee's actions were not racially motivated.
Boycott Gibson!
But the allegations of racism sparked by the shoplifting incident led to the protests and the calls for the boycott. Later, the bakery filed a lawsuit accusing the college and a top administrator at the school of supporting the protesters' claims. The bakery had ties with Oberlin College and claimed in the lawsuit that the college had stopped working with the bakery after the protests. A jury found that the college libeled the bakery, inflicted emotional distress, and interfered with business relationships. The jury awarded the bakery $11 million in damages. We did reach out to Oberlin College for comment on the case, and we did not hear back. In Oberlin, I'm Annie Abraham, Channel 3 News.
All right, Channel 3 News is based in Cleveland. That's WKYC, and that's a very interesting report. Who would think that a college known for its great musicians and scholarship, not very big, in the cornfields of Ohio would become the center of such storm? How in the world did Oberlin College become so politically correct, and what happened when this award was awarded by the jury just recently? How did this all happen? I've asked Peter Wood to join us this morning. Peter is the president of the National Association of Scholars. Peter himself is a scholar, and we've talked to him many times on the air because National Association of Scholars is really on the cutting edge of pulling America's colleges and universities back from the brink of, shall we say, leftism, socialism, everything that moral depravity. The list could go on. And so Peter joins us this morning because I knew that he would be following this very carefully. So Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, I'm just curious about on the spectrum of radicalism, before this issue, before this jury awarded the bakery, and we'll talk more about the details of that, what was Oberlin, what's its radical temperature? Has it been radical for a long time?
It has always been on the progressive liberal edge over its entire history. It has, under its previous president, Marvin Krisloff, made a pretty hard turn to the far left. And there were news stories over the last decade that benchmarked that. There was the incident of a woman walking home late at night with a blanket wrapped around her who got reported as a member of the Ku Klux Klan. There was a graffiti campaign in which two white progressive students marred the campus with racist slogans. They got caught by the police, but Krisloff covered it up in order to create a teachable moment and suspended classes and taught the students that they were subtly infiltrated by white supremacists when he knew that that was a lie. So there have been incidents and others in that vein that indicated that Oberlin was leaning hard towards going along with making up stories and feeding a degree of racial and social justice paranoia. So the Gibson Bakery affair which began under Krisloff, he retired mid-course in this, has about it an air of the inevitable. This is Oberlin College bending itself out of shape in order to appease radicalized students and to radicalize them further, jumping into an affair in which it had no business at all.
Yeah, let me flesh a little bit of a few more of the details out, Peter. As I understand it, this bakery has been in existence since 1885. They started with like a little cart business, and now it's maybe the third or fourth, I don't know what generation, but it's the same generation, same family, just a different generation. And it was the grandson and son who was 32, something like that, who was minding the store when this black student came in and tried to steal, did steal, actually, a bottle of wine. Several bottles. He ran out after him, tried to tackle him. The other two friends of the student who stole the bottles started beating on the Gibson grandson, and it was all settled in court. They pled guilty. They actually signed a statement, as I understand it, that it was not racism. And then why don't you take it from there, Peter? How did Oberlin respond to that?
Well, after the students had been arrested, but before they had pled guilty, the word got out, apparently from the shoplifter, Mr. Aladdin, that he complained, oh, this is racism. That quickly got taken up by student activists at Oberlin, and they were under the, say, strong influence of the dean of students, a woman named Meredith Raimondo, who has been sort of preaching for quite some time that student activism is a wonderful thing. Raimondo took it upon herself to help organize the students, get them out in front of the store protesting. Over 100 students were there. She showed up as well, bullhorn, flyers in hand, participated fully in the protest. As several observers put it, she orchestrated the protest. By the way, one of the people who testified to the orchestrating was a black employee of Gibson's Bakery. Some of the protesters went inside, both on that occasion and on later occasions, and harassed customers. But Oberlin, from the get-go, became involved with the student protesters. It allowed its copy machines to be used for printing up the flyers. It gave the protesters space in which to meet and organize their tactics. When some members of the faculty of Oberlin College remonstrated with the administration that this was unfair and not a good way to go, the other administrators responded with profanity and told them to get lost in much harsher language than that. And we found that the college made a thing out of this campaign against the bakery. The owners of the bakery protested to the college and were given very brusque dismissals. The college officials, without any real knowledge of this, bought into the storyline, which traces back to Raimondo, that Gibson's Bakery had a history of racial profiling and racism. Now, it's very important to get into the story right away that that is not true. The bakery did have a shoplifting problem. There were 40 instances between 2011 and 2016 in which the shoplifters were apprehended by the police. Of those 40 instances, more than 4 out of 5 of them were Oberlin students who were the perpetrators. 32 of those arrested were white, 6 were black, and 2 were Asian. That's not racial profiling.
Not hardly.
It represents precisely the percentages of those racial categories in the Oberlin community. It is a shoplifting problem of some magnitude. Surely not everyone who shoplifted was apprehended. Probably hundreds of cases weren't. The student newspaper at Oberlin reported on this somewhat proudly in December of 2017 as Oberlin's culture of theft. that's their words for it, and quoted many students, including the writer of the article, about how easy it was to pilfer from the local businesses. And it's sort of a point of pride. The students were saying, well, yeah, I could have paid, but I preferred not to. So Gibson's Bakery was on the alert for shoplifters. It didn't have to be racially profiling anyone. In this particular case, the student first tried to buy wine with a fake ID. He was turned away, but then young Mr. Gibson noticed that Jonathan Aladdin had bottles of wine under his jacket, followed him out, and confronted him across the street from the bakery. And then Aladdin and his two female companions, Cecilia Whetstone and Endia Lawrence, attacked him. They had him down on the ground where they were kicking him when the police showed up and arrested the three perpetrators. And the rest of the story is as you told it.
Yes, and one of the things that, one other additional piece of information, as I understand it, Oberlin stopped doing business with the bakery, and they had for decades, centuries, you could argue, in our century anyway, done business with the bakery. They stopped doing that, at least for a time, and there was so much disruption that people stopped shopping there. The owners said people would come in like the back door and hide. They were afraid to be seen, and so their business was devastated, and so all that to say, last week or recently then, the jury just awarded them $11 million and then $33 million for punitive damages, which is incredible. But I think, Peter, the thing now that I want to ask you is we have an epidemic of political correctness, and that's even too kind a word, of radical leftism where truth is nowhere to be found, where kids are just like, it's a madness, and it's like epidemic in colleges and universities. So what will this mean to an out-of-control, politically correct college like Oberlin?
Well, this could be the long-sought inflection point when the American public begins to get an accurate reading on what is happening in the elite levels of American higher education. And I think it's fair to say that Oberlin College, with its almost 3,000 students, is in that elite category. It's a selective college. What it is doing is turning its students into lawless thugs. They didn't care about whether Gibson's Bakery was actually engaged in racist policy. It went into place with the encouragement of the college officials. They sought the college to break its commercial ties to the bakery and were perfectly ready to run this old bakery into the ground. When challenged on the value of the bakery, they said it was worth $35,000, I think was the figure. The jury was incensed by all this, as and rightly should be. What is this teaching Americans? Well, I think it teaches us that our elite colleges are much more interested in turning students into social justice warriors who don't care about the truth, but want to advance a narrative that America is a racist country and that every little business everywhere is complicit in this racism. The college defends itself, and I think this is an important piece to add, by saying that what it was actually doing was protecting the free speech rights of its students. So if the students wanted to call an innocent business a bastion of racism, that was an act of free speech, and it was the college's obligation both to protect the students' ability to engage in this slanderous activity and to encourage their spirit of seeking social justice through this vein.
Peter, hold that thought. Yes. Lawlessness. Absolutely. Peter Wood is my guest. He's the president of the National Association of Scholars. And when we return, I just want to say a few more words about Oberlin because I've learned some interesting things about them. Peter, I want to ask you, why Oberlin when we get back? Why that little place in the middle of Ohio? Why has it been targeted by radical leftists with tons of money? Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Kyle Kashub says he and some others were trying to be as extreme and shocking as possible when he used the N-word repeatedly, including about black student athletes. The offensive comments were made in a Google document that served as a chat space and was shared among several friends. But somebody retrieved the document and posted screenshots of it in a video on Twitter. Kashub says at the time he was thoughtless and immature, and that he made the remarks months before the Parkland shooting that killed 17 of his classmates. But it appears some former students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School wanted nothing to do with his apology and took the matter directly to Harvard, asking the college to rescind Kashub's admission. Kashub then apologized to Harvard for the, quote, hurtful things he wrote, saying he's no longer the same person, especially in the wake of the shooting, and asked how he could right this wrong. It didn't help. In a letter that Kyle Kashub shared publicly, Harvard wrote in part, quoting, as you know, the committee takes seriously the qualities of maturity and moral character. After careful consideration, the committee voted to rescind your admission to Harvard College. Kashub now believes that he was targeted more for his politics than his offensive comments. Remember, in the wake of the Parkland shooting, he became a prominent media figure who supported gun rights and became the high school outreach director for a conservative group with ties to the Trump family. Today he tweeted, quoting, after I issued this apology, speculative articles were written, my peers used the opportunity to attack me, and my life was once again reduced to a headline. It sent me into one of the darkest spirals of my life. In 2017, Harvard also rescinded admission for at least 10 students who shared sexually explicit and racist messages on Facebook. Two other students who graduated this year from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High will be attending Harvard in the fall. Kyle Kashub is unclear where he will attend.
All right, that was Trace Gallagher of Fox News. And the point of me playing that is just to illustrate, look, you could argue till the cows come home about Kyle's statements when he was 16. No defense of that. But the point is this. Colleges and universities, there is no question, will be screening your kids. We'll be finding out how they feel about things politically, and they will be allowed in or out or rejected or accepted based on what they think about issues not related to their academic ability. There's just no question about it. This is where we're heading. My guests are Peter Wood, who's the president of the National Association of Scholars, and joining us is Rochelle Peterson, who's the director of research projects for the National Association of Scholars. Rochelle, thanks for joining us, too.
Thank you, Sandy.
Oh, you know what? Without getting off track here, just say a word, Rochelle, say a word about what you think the implications of Kyle's his loss of his ability to get into Harvard means more broadly.
I think this is a sign of how successful student activism has been and how susceptible colleges and universities are to it. They've been saying that student activism is important, that it's more important than your academic studies. And here's Harvard bowing down to a couple of Kashub's classmates starting an activist campaign against him and sending it to the admissions office.
Very dangerous. It really is. It's very dangerous for academic freedom, I think. Peter, let's go back to Oberlin for a second. In reading about Oberlin and their history a little bit, I was really struck by the fact that you mentioned earlier they have 2,800 students. That's pretty modest. But they have an $887.4 million endowment. Can you explain that?
Well, I think it can only be explained by the willingness of the alumni over the years to donate large amounts of money to the enterprise. Now, some of that is a reflection of the what used to be called idealism. I'm not sure that word applies anymore. But the readiness of the alumni to see the college as playing a key role in advancing rights for minorities and seeking a better form of life in America has taken a very sinister turn in the last decade. But it remains that the college inherits the wealth of previous generations devoted to a vision of the good life advanced by intellectual inquiry.
I also have found, and perhaps you know this, Peter, you probably do, the chairman of the board, or the trustees, the chairman of the board of trustees is Chris Canavan, who happens to be the director of global policy development for the Soros Fund Management. out of New York.
How about that?
Yeah, how about that? So I go back to my question. Honestly, not that you can't answer this, but I'm curious. Why this little college in the cornfields of Ohio, why would you target, if you're a leftist, why would you say we're going to radicalize that place?
Because it's rich, because it has prestige, that it is a place where future leaders of America and probably better numbers than from your average state college or university are going to be cultivated, and because it's a hothouse where you can be sure that you can control almost every detail of student life. So it's all that. But then, of course, the takeover of an institution like that depends on getting in place the administrators who will enforce the political program of the left. So President Kristoloff was a key figure in that change, and his successor, Carmen Amber, is another who intends to keep the college on track as a breeding ground for the next generation of progressive leaders.
So that makes me want to share this. The current president, whose name you just gave, in response to the lawsuit, said none of this will sway us from our core values.
The president took me by surprise. I thought she might be a moderating influence after the Kristoloff years, but it turns out that she's as dedicated as he was into making the college a instrument of political agency rather than a place of genuine liberal education. So what are their core values? Their core values appear to be aggravating America's current unease over race and trying to promote the notion that their notions of social justice trump the pursuit of truth or fairness.
Isn't it interesting? You know, I suppose a college like Oberlin that has an $887.4 million endowment won't miss $33 plus $11 million. They won't miss it that much. And one wonders if it really will have impact on them as the how committed, you know, we have to ask and we don't know, are the trustees to their radicalism? Will they start saying, you know, maybe we should change things a little bit? I guess that's what remains to be seen.
Well, Mr. Soros could easily make up with it with his own contributions. I don't think Oberlin is likely to be swayed by the judgment, no matter how large it ends up being after the courts get through whittling it down. I do think, however, that this is a statement that will reach many other colleges and universities and many members of the public. It states emphatically that something has gone seriously wrong with the way we're educating the next generation, and it opens up the possibility that those colleges that are somewhat more sensitive to their finances will look at this and say, we don't want to go where Oberlin went.
Let me change the subject for a second. I want to ask you, both of you, Rochelle Peterson and also Peter Wood, to respond to this. This is kind of, this didn't make the news. It is reported in the American Conservative, but there is a scholar and a statesman named Ryszard Legutko, who is from Poland. And he traveled to Vermont at the invitation of Middlebury College, everyone's familiar with Middlebury, to do a speaking engagement. He landed and found out that there's been such an uproar that he would not be allowed to speak. And these are his words. He said, on my way to Vermont, which took me a couple of days, I started receiving information about some students and professors planning to organize protests against my speaking at the campus. They issued a statement that I was a homophobe, a blanking homophobe, as they put it on Facebook, a misogynist, a racist, a sexist, and practically everything an ideological sinner can be today. And so he goes on and tells his story, which is fascinating, by the way. I commend all of you listening to this article. It's called Legutko, Enemy of the Politrux. And so, but I want to read this part to you guys, because this is from a book that he just wrote called The Demon in Democracy. And I just would be interesting to get your feedback. He says, the book is about how liberal democracy tends to develop the qualities that were characteristic of communism: pervasive politicization, ideological zeal, aggressive social engineering, vulgarity, and belief in inevitability of progress, destruction of family, the omnipresent rule of ideological correctness, severe restriction of intellectual inquiry. All of these I remember from my young days in communism, and all these I have been observing with a growing sense of alarm in today's liberal democracy. He says a lot more, but I'll leave it with that. I just would be interesting to hear your comments on that, either of you. Rochelle, maybe you first.
Well, I think his description is very accurate of the society that we are living in today. It's disturbing, and it's true. And even more disturbing is that the institutions that are supposed to be the keepers of our culture, the setters of high standards, our colleges and universities, are actually inculcating in students all of those bad tendencies that you just read from his quote.
Peter, any further thoughts from you? And then I'm going to change to a different project that you guys were key on. But any more thoughts about what we just heard from that scholar?
Yes, there has been a theme in scholarship for at least half a century that a liberal democracy like America has potentially within it the seeds of its own destruction. And he's just unpacked that in a way that sounds uncannily accurate for where America is right now. That is, we value freedom and we seek equality, but freedom and equality left to the hands of those who have no higher values in life at all can become kind of a self-poison. That is, we don't want to turn against those values, but unless we match them with some regard for higher truths, we are on a path to undermining those values themselves. So you can get rid of freedom in the name of freedom. You can undermine equality in the name of equality. And that, unfortunately, is what we've been seeing at places like Overland and at Middlebury.
You know what really surprises me, Peter? When you think about the writings of the Founding Fathers, this was no surprise to them. And they wrote about it. I could read 20 quotes of the Founding Fathers saying democracy itself would be a disaster, that it can't survive, a free society can't survive, they said, without religion and morality. Those are the two words they used, religion and morality. Because a freedom for freedom's sake is just not enough. There has to be something else causing people to have self-restraint. But enough of that for the moment. One of the main things that you guys, from my perspective, have accomplished in the last couple of years is the exposition or exposing of Confucius Institutes in institutions of higher learning. Now, we've talked about it on this program a number of times, but it's been a while. So, Rochelle, let me turn to you to sort of give us a brief overview of what that was about and where we are now with it.
Confucius Institutes are Chinese government-sponsored centers on college campuses offering classes on Chinese language and culture using textbooks that the Chinese government chooses, using teachers that are selected by the Chinese government and paid by the Chinese government. And NIS exposed this 2 years ago now, and we have been very gratified to see that the federal government has started to investigate this. Two dozen colleges and universities have now closed their Confucius Institutes, and we're seeing an increased awareness of all the opportunities that exist for foreign governments to take advantage of our colleges and universities by making generous financial donations and then getting some access to students and access to the curriculum in return.
So do you think that this, and the Congress has gotten involved, do you think they're actually going to turn this back? When this started, I'm guessing, was in the heyday of, hey, let's trade with China. It's a huge market, and they're, after all, not so bad after all. I would say in the 80s, the 90s. I'm guessing that's when they got their foothold. So do you think that this work of the Congress and this public exposition or exposing of this is going to really be able to root it out, Rochelle?
I am optimistic, though a lot of work remains to be done. We have seen 24 colleges close their Confucius Institutes. There are, however, about 90 Confucius Institutes remaining in the country, and many of those universities that host them have been very defensive of their Confucius Institutes. And we are seeing a lot of defenses of foreign funding of colleges and universities saying, well, if the colleges need the money, why not accept it from another country, even if there are strings attached? So there's a lot that remains to be done. However, we are at a moment when the American people are seeing the reach of foreign influence in colleges and universities, and when both houses of Congress are aware of this and taking it seriously, and where colleges and universities are facing a lot of pressure to take some steps to protect themselves from undue interference from another country.
Let me just stop to be very practical. If you are, you have a student, or you're thinking about sending your student away, your student's already in college, or you got grandchildren, you will want to look at NAS.org. NAS.org. It will be a great source of information about colleges and universities, which of them have the Confucius Institutes, and a whole lot more, which we're going to talk about with Rochelle on the other side of the break. We're going to say goodbye to Peter Wood, the president of National Association of Scholars, which I can't say enough about his work and their work. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
And thank you.
When we return, we'll talk to Rochelle about a broader project, which will rattle you. It will. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The U.S. Senate is blasting Chinese learning centers at more than 100 American universities. The Senate's Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs issued a report saying Confucius Institute-run learning centers should either be overhauled or be closed altogether. The 93-page report suggests all teachers, events, and speakers are first approved by the Chinese government, and some of the schools agree to comply with both Chinese and U.S. laws. Funding from the Chinese government is reportedly not always disclosed either, as the report notes. Nearly 70% of U.S. schools with a Confucius Institute that received more than $250,000 in 1 year failed to properly report that information to the Department of Education. It also alleges that the centers are a propaganda tool aimed at attempting to change the impression in the United States and around the world that China is an economic and security threat. The report argues that without full transparency into the organization's operations, as well as reciprocating American culture outreach efforts at Chinese colleges, Confucius Institutes should stop operating in the U.S. Already this year, at least three American universities have closed their centers run by the organization.
All right, that was a report from Time Magazine. And I have to tell you, the National Association of Scholars was responsible for that. A lot of us tried to help them get the word out, but they did the hard work of this, testified. Honestly, I just want to let people know, Rochelle, what you guys have accomplished. But the problem does not end there. By the way, Rochelle Peterson is my guest. She's the Director of Research Projects for the National Association of Scholars. There is an incredible expose, Rochelle, which you may have seen, by Luke Rosiak in Daily Caller. It's not the only outlet talking about this, but he does a great job reporting that now the Department of Education is looking into many elite colleges who are taking millions and millions of dollars from foreign entities that are not our friends. Islamic influence is a huge problem at American University, Harvard, Yale, UC Berkeley, Ohio State, Michigan, and Vanderbilt. And in fact, I'll just mention that Georgetown has received nearly $333 million from Qatar since 2011. Why should we be concerned about these things, Rochelle? What's the problem with that? They need money, and maybe that would lower the tuition for American students or some such thing. What's the problem here?
The problem is that foreign governments know that American colleges and universities want money and are financially vulnerable. And so they make these generous donations and put strings attached to those gifts. So often there are restrictions on academic freedom, restrictions on what can be taught, on who can be hired, or kind of implicit agreements about, you know, if you get this money, then you better not be criticizing our country and make sure your professors aren't being critical of us either. So there's a quid pro quo, and that in itself is bad, but it's doubly bad because these are colleges and universities that are teaching the next generation of students, students whose views are being shaped, who, you know, what they learn about a given country in college is going to stay with them for the rest of. And so if they're being fed a one-sided scripted view of a nation like Qatar or China or some of these nations that are making large donations to colleges and universities. That's a very serious matter.
You know, in regard to Georgetown and a few others, my understanding is that they've been selected, and it's not happening now, but I guess it's happened in the last few years, to oversee the writing of textbooks for the American educational system, and how to talk about the Middle East, how to frame these things. And so it just so happens that most of the schools that were selected to frame the discussion on Islam in the Middle East in American textbooks have been given tons of money by Saudi Arabia, by Qatar. I mean, that to me is, in fact, just to illustrate the problem, the Luke Rosiak reports that in 2008, a congressman asked Georgetown if it had ever written any reports critical of Saudi Arabia since they've been receiving these huge amounts of funds. Georgetown didn't answer, by the way. So you get the drift of why this is so serious. What else do you know about, Rochelle, of the kinds of money and the kinds of things that are being exchanged and used in a very unhealthy way for our democracy?
Well, you're right that many of these universities are developing textbooks for K-12 schools, and that is a repercussion of actually a federal law saying that if you get federal money for Middle East study centers, you should be serving the public by helping these K-12 schools. Well, foreign governments found out about that and instantly saw an incentive to start funding these centers as well. And the result, as you say, is that they're producing textbooks for K-12 students that are very one-sided, that are giving them very one-sided materials on what Islam is and what the Middle East is like. And in addition to that, American universities are developing other problematic ties with these governments. Georgetown and Texas A&M, which are both under investigation right now, have branch campuses in Qatar that are strongly funded by the nation of Qatar. They're money makers for Texas A&M and for Georgetown. And dozens of other American colleges have branch campuses in other countries that essentially just function as a way to funnel money to their American campuses and collect funds from the nation where the branch campus is located.
You know, since you mentioned Texas A&M, we have a lot of listeners in Texas, Rochelle, and I want to sit on that just for a second. Texas A&M, who's been, you know, they're the Aggies. They're like Texas, for heaven's sakes. People that graduate from Texas A&M are very proud and very Texas. And so one wouldn't think that they would be like working with Qatar is the way I understand it's pronounced. But anyway, Luke Rosiak in his expose asked Texas A&M to turn over their records because the donors for these universities are supposed to be public because they're public universities. Texas A&M did not do that. Instead, they alerted Qatar, which hired a politically connected law firm that took legal action to tie up the request. And so that's what Luke reports in this piece. So you see how money corrupts. It just does. Regardless of where it comes from, Rochelle, money can. It has the potential of corrupting. Huge amounts of money have the potential of really hugely corrupting, and I think that's what we're seeing here. This is another part. This really disturbed me. This is back to Georgetown. Now, Georgetown trains diplomats for the Foreign Service. I mean, they advertise, and people come from all over the country. It's really a prestigious thing to have a degree from Georgetown, and it will probably get you directly into Foreign Service. A lot of graduates. I just have to tell people that when they're watching television, watching pundits, how many of them do you hear graduated from Georgetown? Lots, I'd say. And so Saudi Arabia has given Georgetown $20 million to set up what's called the Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. Now, Rochelle, do you know about that entity?
I do. It's funded by a member of the Saudi royal family who has set up, I think, 7 of these centers around the world. There's also one at Harvard, and there's a similar one, though from a different donor, at Yale as well. And these basically function as propaganda units for Saudi Arabia and basically proselytizing centers for Islam, in which you will never hear anything alarming about Islam, and in which they go to great lengths to try to rehabilitate the history of Islam, including an infamous lecture at Georgetown on why slavery under Islam was not such a bad thing.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten about that, actually. And let me just say that the Center for Muslim Christian Understanding, which is the institute we're talking about, which was paid for $20 million by Saudi, their website basically is supposed to be the Center for Muslim Christian Understanding, okay? But the website says it, quote, reframes Islamophobia as, quote, anti-Muslim racism, end quote, sharing an enemy in, quote, white supremacy with other U.S. minority groups. And then it talks about, quote, resisting anti-Muslim racism using, quote, hip-hop. So we can see why one has to only look into things like this to understand, Rochelle, why our young people are so confused and uninformed, ill-informed. It's starting in their textbooks, which have been written by people who are being paid off not to tell the truth, and then they grow up and go to college and echo that same erroneous message about various things. What do you see as the fix for this?
Well, one small fix, and this is where we are starting to see some good news, is that we're starting to see a push for transparency. This is not a total solution, but at the very least, we need colleges and universities to be honest about these massive amounts of money that they're taking from other countries. We see the Department of Education is now investigating Georgetown and Texas A&M for failure to disclose some of these gifts, and we've seen multiple members of Congress toying with the idea about how to increase the transparency requirements. But beyond that, we need some kind of limits on the amount of money that colleges and universities can take from foreign governments and what that money can be used for, especially if it's going to subsidize programs that are also funded by the federal government. So last year we saw passed into law, signed by President Trump, a law banning the use of Pentagon funding for programs that are connected to Confucius Institutes. And that led to many universities closing down their Confucius Institutes. We need more laws like that, that ban federal funding to programs that are double dipping from these foreign funders, as a way to incentivize colleges and universities to start cutting these improper ties to foreign donors.
You know, Rochelle, whenever I think of the Department of Education, it doesn't bring me fond memories or warm, fuzzy thoughts. and I don't think about its great power to exert its influence on public and lower and higher education. Do you think they have the teeth to make something like this significant? I really don't know.
Well, that remains to be seen. This is the first time ever the Department of Education has investigated a college for failing to report foreign funds. Under the law, they have the ability to, if they find a violation, they can refer it to the Justice Department, and the Attorney General can bring a suit and require the college or university to pay a fine. Some members of Congress are toying with the idea of instituting mandatory fines for violations of these federal transparency laws and stiffening those fines so that colleges and universities will take this law seriously. I think that's a good idea. But even if the Department of Education cannot lead to a sea change in what colleges and universities are doing, at the very least, it's good that they are finally taking this law seriously and at least trying to enforce it. And we're seeing additional colleges and universities paying attention to the fact that the Department of Education is starting to get on top of this.
If parents are concerned, they're listening, they've got college-age kids, or grandparents are listening, how can they equip themselves? What can they do with what you and I've talked about? Is there something in writing? Is there some measure? Is there some repository where they can figure out if they, the college or university that the kids have chosen is a safe place for them to go in regard to this problem?
Well, NAS maintains a list of every Confucius Institute in the country. Go to nas.org and click on our reports. You'll find our entire report on Confucius Institutes, as well as an updated list of every college in the country with Confucius Institute. We update that on an almost daily basis whenever there's an update, so it's up to date. In addition to that, the Department of Education does publish the reports of foreign gifts. They publish it every 6 months on their website. You can see exactly what money colleges and universities have gotten from foreign governments. As we've been talking about, it hasn't been well enforced, and that information is not exhaustive, but it can give you a good picture of where your child's college is getting its money from.
Well, then we're kind of on the front end of this particular problem. Let me just say that this article by Luke Rosiak is a great resource, and we'll put this on our Facebook page. It's Foreign Meddling, Department of Education Going After Elite Colleges for Allegedly Taking and Hiding Foreign Cash. That's not the half of it, seems to me. It needs to be a longer headline, if that's possible. Rochelle Peterson, it's always a pleasure. National Association of Scholars is NAS.org, NAS.org, and feel free to join them. You can join if you like what they do. You don't have to be a scholar. I belong. I guess I feel like I have my PhD in current events, though, Rochelle. I have to tell you that. But anyway, it's great to talk to you. Thank you to you and Peter for all the work that you do and for providing such great information for my listeners. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.